Tell me about your academic and your professional background.
Sure. So I went to undergrad at Emory University in Atlanta, just a couple hours away, and I did my graduate work at the University of Miami in Florida, not the Ohio one. So it was great being around a lot of athletes. It was really good exposure to student athletes because most people think it's like a Florida State or an Ohio State. It's only 8,000 students and it's a private school, but they have such prominent sports programs that you see a different side of college athletics than you would at a major state university. So after I graduated, I worked there for one more year and I took a job at UAB. So I'm a sociologist now at UAB. I mostly study racial and sex disparities in sports and political contexts.
Why did you get into this line of work? What fascinated you about it?
I was actually an athlete growing up. I was a competitive basketball player. And after my freshman year of college, I was in a very bad car accident and I wasn't able to play anymore. And, you know, lots of people lose their careers. It's kind of like grieving, especially at a lower level. I know I've seen it happen with football players professionally and basketball players, some of the guys I've taught at Miami at the major levels. But I didn't, you know, I really miss sports and I didn't realize there was a career in studying sports until I went to graduate school and met my mentor, Joe Mills Braddock, who used to run a sports research center there. And I took his class on racism and sports context. And ever since then, I realized that I can continue to be around sports and study sports and try to improve experiences for athletes and those on the periphery. So that's how I really got into the sports research, was at graduate school, and continued on here at UAB, where we have such an amazing resources for studying health and health disparities.
Would I be right to say that you're mainly or at least very interested in the inequality faced by marginalized groups in sports?
Yes, that's my main area of interest. And also outside of sports context a little bit. I've been studying police brutality a little bit, the Trayvon Martin case as well. I've been studying the election of Barack Obama and white's racial attitudes pre and post his inauguration and his second term. So I'm really interested in racial disparities in all contexts. And sports is specifically interesting to me, though, because people think it's meritocratic. So most institutions, people know, okay, you know, we've never had a female president, or the criminal justice system is flawed, or the education systems, we can tell that there's disparities between schools by income. But sports people think, look at all the representation of historically disadvantaged groups, specifically blacks, it must be fair. So when you can point out the disparities in sports context, you can say, well, what are the implications for the criminal justice system then? If we think sports are equal and they're so unequal, then what else is going on in our other social institutions?
So you kind of see it as an indicator or maybe a barometer of other institutions, other things happening in society?
Yes, definitely. We like to say that sports are a prism through which we can examine inequality and that they both reflect and reproduce inequities. So we see disparities in sports in terms of decision-making processes or access to participation, and it's a cyclical event where if you're not giving certain groups, such as blacks, access to, you know, low contact, low injury sports like tennis and golf, you're going to have less of a role modeling effect and even prevent further access into these sports. So, you know, it's sports basically are, you know, just like any other societal system, they reflect and reproduce inequities.
So the average, you know, sort of run-of-the-mill sports spectator looks at the NFL or the NBA, where there's a lot of money to be made. Now, granted, a lot of people do get injured. How do you sort of make the case that these sports are not meritocratic?
So, I mean, we can look at disparities in things like coaching and decision-making. You know, in 2003, there was a great article, a scholarly article, that came out about penalized sports behavior. You know, we can say there could be a rule every time there is a Native American mascot that a team has to lose a touchdown. There could be a rule that if they see a Confederate flag in the stadium, that there's a 20-yard penalty. But instead, we have something like excessive celebration penalties, which is an attack, I would say, on Black culture. And lots of scholars, specifically Simons, has said this for a while. We've seen this with the Williams sisters, with attack on their hairstyle or their outfit choices, and attack on Black bodies specifically with the Williams sisters as well. So we can see these things in some of the rule development, and it's because we don't have a diverse representation of people in decision-making processes, whether that be racial minorities or women. We can also see this in ownership, coaching, upper levels, and also in peripheral positions as team doctors, team accountants, personal agents, these sorts of things, where we are still seeing a lack of women and racial minorities. So when we talk about, you can see athletes, but athletes are, the majority of them are on the lowest spectrum of people being able to make a decent living for a long time. So we talked about the average career in the NFL is around 3 years, where, you know, you can be a doctor for a team and make a lot more money for 40 years, or an owner, a coach, for decades. So that's where you can see some of these disparities in decision-making processes and also to access.
I have so many questions. Wow.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
That's
it's fascinating. Okay, wait. Backtrack to something you said a while ago. So end zone dancing, excessive celebration. Some people see that as the penalties against that are somehow against Black culture. Tease that out for me. Explain that.
So we would like to look at as scholars. We have the word a lot in America, tradition. Okay, so and we get a little hypocritical when we talk about tradition. I mean, we could say anything's a tradition. We could say lynchings were a tradition, or slavery was a tradition, or, you know, raping your wife, it was a tradition. Okay, so when we say something like this is a tradition, like the fight songs or the mascots or the Confederate flag at Ole Miss or whatever it is. And then we talk about free speech as well. So it's the hypocrisy of, well, who gets to have free speech in these sorts of traditions? We can give the KKK free speech to march or to demonstrate, but we can't let someone dance or pray, which was what happened in the last example where a player was penalized for praying to Allah because that wasn't something that the referees had typically witnessed.
When was that? Tell me more about that.
So a player last year, or during the season, when he scored a touchdown, he dropped to his knees and he bowed, which was not a usual form of celebration. Especially, we have the Tebowing and the most people pointing to the sky. Thank you, God, for touchdowns. So instead, when someone did a different demonstration for praying, they were given an excessive celebration penalty. And later, the referee came out and said that it was a mistake and it shouldn't have happened. But it's, you know, this lack of exposure that we can see, you know, who has access to being even a referee? You know, we don't have a lot of Muslim representation or female representation or whatever else.
I understand you've been studying the sort of career paths of African-American athletes who mostly end up in certain kinds of sports and are shunted away from other kinds. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so I'm completing a study with two of my colleagues, Liz Baker and Hannah Boudwani. And what we're looking at is high school participation, because obviously high school participation in sports is going to lead to participation in college and furthermore into the professional realms. And when we see these disparities of overrepresentation of African Americans in sports like football, with high levels of injury, and especially the traumatic brain injury and the concussion research that's just coming out, we're trying to see, well, where does that start? And, you know, we can say a lot of these individual level factors. Does it start with a father or brother in the home who played football? Or does it start with being, you know, physically large? Where does this happen? And we think it's something else going on. So we're seeing a huge overrepresentation of Blacks, specifically in football and basketball, in our research. And we're seeing a lack of representation of them in other sports. So that what that's telling us, basically, is it's not just the self-selection into football and basketball. It's the lack of opportunity to play other sports, specifically golf, tennis, crew, and other low-impact sports where you don't have the injury risk. So, you know, we can say that whites do play a lot of sports with high injury risks, like ice hockey or even cheerleading has a really high neck and head injury rate, or something even like equestrianism. But that's a choice where they have access, for the most part, to a wide variety of sports, where we're seeing that African Americans and Hispanics as well are given limited opportunities for such things as basketball, track, and football.
And you're trying to, you and your colleagues are trying to tease that out. That seems like it would be tricky. How do you do that?
So we have multiple levels of data is really the key. So we want to look at, right now we're looking at the individual level data. So people saying, is it important to be an athlete? Am I popular if I'm an athlete? Do I have a brother in the home? Do I have a father in the home who played sports? Those sorts of things. And looking at other factors like socioeconomic status and race specifically. But then it's also important to have the school level data of what does the school offer. So if you're seeing, you know, people are only playing these sports, it's not just because they love the sport, they want to be good at it, or they're encouraged by their parents or perhaps by society even, but because they just literally can't play anything else if it's not there.
So it's a question of access too.
Yes.
Just put very simply.
Yeah. So, and there's very few studies on access, and that's something, you know, that is what equity is. I believe, and my colleague Joe Mills Braddock as well has taught me over the years. He lived through segregation, and you know, desegregation was not about, do we need Harvard to be 50% Black, 50% white? It was, can Black students get to Harvard? Can they succeed there? That is the whole point of access. And when you have an overrepresentation of a certain racial group in a violent sport such as football that is causing years off people's lives and degenerate brain injuries, I would say that this is an epidemic. When you have a certain racial group being funneled into a violent sport such as football, where we are seeing more and more studies, results that state that traumatic brain injury is happening, I would call this an epidemic where, again, whites, if they're selecting into the UFC or they're selecting into other violent sports such as hockey, they still have the opportunities to play low-impact sports like golf and tennis, where we're not giving African Americans the same opportunities.
So you see this goes back to your central focus of sort of the intersection of sports and politics and history. You see this as just another segment of society where inequity sort of shows itself.
Yes. And I mean, we're talking about life and death. I mean, this really is a question when you're looking at 76 out of 79 deceased NFL players had traumatic brain injuries. I think the other statistic was almost 80% of those who donated their brain tissue who played, even at the college level, or semi-professional levels, are having these types of brain injuries. So we've seen different studies that estimate that NFL players are taking 20 years off their life. We don't even know what the end outcomes are because, as we know, the sport is getting more and more violent. We're hitting harder. We have more physical prowess in terms of weightlifting and sleeping in hyperbaric chambers and creatine and supplements and all these things. So we're hitting at higher rates, and we're not implementing more and more safety regulations that are preventing these injuries. So we don't even know what the outcomes are going to be in decades to come.
You're a former athlete yourself. What do you see as the benefits of playing sports, of getting involved with athletics?
Right. So I teach a sport class.
A sports sociology class.
Yes, the sport in society. Yes.
Okay.
And I think people come to the class because they love sports and they want to talk about all the positives. And there are many positives. We can talk about anything from, you know, decreasing obesity to social interaction to meeting people that are diverse, from learning teamwork and cooperation. Also, in terms of learning how to win and lose, all those sorts of things are really important in sports. We can also see that most people don't realize that sports promote academics. A lot of people think that there's a divide between academics and athletics, but most studies show that athletes actually do better in school during their seasons because they know, okay, I'm going to be traveling on these days, so I have to get my homework done, or I want to remain eligible, or my coach keeps asking me how my science test went. So academics are actually positively influenced by athletic participation
Is that
as well.
College level, high school, across the board?
Across the board, pretty much. We can also see things, mental health benefits. We saw my colleague Elizabeth Baker and I just published a study on how athletic participation for women might lower their rates of intimate partner violence through the mechanism of self-esteem. So female athletes might develop a self-concept that's less limited by feminine ideals and therefore might be more likely to either select partners that are not abusive or to get out of a relationship that is abusive. And there's a lot of other factors like socioeconomic status and college attendance, which affect these outcomes. But we do see a lot of positives in athletics. And I think that's why I'm so passionate about improving access and improving the social system of sport, because we want everyone to be able to reap the benefits. And overall, society can benefit from these sorts of outcomes as well. You know, society hurts when there's intimate partner violence. Society suffers when we have safety concerns in our sport. Society hurts when there's eating disorders and other sorts of things that athletics might prevent.
You have a paper coming out fairly soon. Fingers crossed everything goes
yes.
well with you and your two colleagues
yes.
who you mentioned
yes.
before. What is your data? What does your data show?
Our data mostly shows that throughout the country, 8th, 10th, and 12th graders who are Black are highly overrepresented in the sport of football. With whites, we see that they have a lot more access to other sports like golf, crew, baseball, and so on. So our data is showing also that Black students and Black males, we're looking at in particular Black high school boys, are saying that it's important to be a good athlete. That's one of our main predictor variables. And the most interesting part about that is it's mostly football players who are saying that. So there's something going on with this association between being an athlete and football for Black men specifically, where maybe whites, Asian men, and Hispanic men might say, well, it's really important to be an athlete in other contexts besides football. So we see a little bit of an overrepresentation in of Hispanics in soccer, which makes sense, where most people around the world, that is obviously the number one sport. So we see these associations, and again, we can't explain, though, all the data through our individual level factors, and that's why we need to continue looking at societal level factors, of education level factors, district factors, in terms of what schools are offering, what neighborhood and other kind of recreation, either AAU or travel teams, what other sports do people of different races have access to? A huge dichotomy as well is between the private school and public schools, where in private schools, most students play sports. And in public schools, less students play sports. You know, it's obvious to see that mostly whites are the ones who attend private schools. So you see these sorts of disparities, not just in individual levels. Why am I playing sports? Do I like sports? Is it important for me? Is it important for my peers? Is it important for my family? But what do I have access to and what is offered to me? Other things that are important as well are, especially for racial minority women, are do I have time to play? Do I have other responsibilities in the home? Is it sexually appropriate for me to play? For Muslim women, is there a dress code that I have to abide by? Is there contact with another sex that's not appropriate? So all of these things are factors, and it's very messy and complicated about what happens with participation. But when we see these huge disparities of overrepresentation of a group that makes up, you know, 10 to 13% of the population, and it's almost 70% of the NFL, we have to wonder, how is this happening and what can we do about it?
I was just going to ask you that. What can be done about that?
So that's a great question. I think, you know, we have to look at access, and that's something that my colleague Jim Osbradek and I, we're really interested in looking at equity of opportunity. So perhaps one thing is on the societal level, again, we don't want to blame individuals. We don't want to tell, you know, individuals you're wrong for self-selecting into these sports, or you shouldn't do this, or, you know, looking at poverty or looking at, you know, individual level factors of, well, you know, you're poor, so this is what you can have. We want to look at how these sports might be offered. Maybe we can look at government subsidies into making public golf courses more readily available, or giving access to swimming pools or something like that, where we want to see a higher level of opportunities in a diverse set of sports offered to a wide number of people. So in other countries, something like golf, it's not as much of a rich person's sport because there's just more courses in low poverty areas. So I think access to a diverse range of sports is really important. And I think also knowledge and education of the risk versus the rewards. I ask a lot of my students, you know, would you want to date someone who's a professional athlete? And most of us would say, oh, yeah, that sounds great. But I mean, think about it. Would you want to have your partner be at risk for concussion? Would you want your partner to be traveling all the time? And also the presentation of opportunities outside of sport is very important. You know, how many racial minorities in America would profit so much more for being told that they can be a doctor, an engineer, or a lawyer versus a professional athlete? The statistics to becoming a professional athlete are so, so small. I mean, 0.00001% of people are going to make it in the NFL, where we really need doctors and lawyers and astronauts and professors and radio broadcasters and everything else. So I think that's also important, is I think diminishing ideology, suggesting that there is some sort of natural superiority of blacks, is incredibly important. That ideology has carried over, and there's absolutely nothing true about it, since race is a social construction. Studies have shown over and over that race is not real in of itself. It's just real in its consequences. So if racial disparities do not exist biologically, we cannot say one group is better or worse at sports. And again, because sports are made up. So sports are social construction. You can't be naturally better. There's no football gene.
You're a former athlete. I've been involved in sports one way or another for most of my life. So this is not coming from someone who does not enjoy sports. But when I see the passion, the worldwide fanaticism, the money, the time, the energy spent on doing things with a ball or watching other people do things with a ball, I can't help but think, imagine if all that effort, energy, time, passion, discipline went into, say, educating kids or solving world hunger or any of the other real problems we face. Are sports overvalued?
I think that's a really interesting question. And I think it's about what aspects of sports are over and undervalued. So there was, I think, a Key and Peele skit, maybe you could look this up and make sure this is true. And they did something like, if teachers were valued as athletes, and looking at these huge, and like you said, the time and the resources and the energy that we expend consuming sports is massive. It really is. And I think sports are not overvalued in the sense that they can be an area for social change. I mean, we saw that Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball before schools were desegregated.
And you think that's important, maybe because it lets people see a black man as a man.
Yes.
I mean, it's not just about what's going on the baseball diamond.
Right. And we, my colleagues from the University of Miami and I, we had a paper on the 2012 London Olympics. This was the first time that we saw women participating in sports from every country around the world, even Saudi Arabia. And we had women participating in hyper-masculine sports such as boxing. So women actually won more Olympic medals and specifically gold medals. So you have men, maybe for, you know, American men, maybe identifying and even cheering for women for the first time, where they might say on, you know, watching a WNBA game is not something they might do, but they might watch a U.S. women's team. And it might be the same for watching someone like Apollo Ono or someone who is a different racial background than most Americans are used to interacting with, a different class background, different sexuality. And that's, you know, we're seeing more and more athletes coming out now. So, I mean, those sorts of exposures to difference are really important in sports context. And like we said before, sports can be incredibly beneficial for physical and mental health. They've impacted other societies like the law, a lot of the privacy law, interstate commerce laws, drug testing. A lot of those things in school context come from sports cases. So we can't underestimate the institution of sport. And unfortunately, sometimes people do. It's not seen as much of a serious area for scholarly inquiry, even though, you know, it is so important. As you mentioned, people deeply care about sports, and it's so linked with other systems such as media, education, the law. I hate to see when female athletes are devalued. I hate to see the association of, you know, black males with brawn and less with brains. I hate to see the idea that certain racial groups shouldn't play, or there's more appropriate sports for different types of people, or even that someone, I hate to see Michael Sam be, you know, is, I don't even know if he'll have a career next year. And we can't continue, though. I don't think sports are going anywhere. And so we can't just say they shouldn't exist, or we have to figure out how to change them. And I think some of the problem with changing sports is that they've been so complicated. So we've seen this with the idea of compensating college athletes. And I think that people have just said this is so complicated that we can't tackle this problem. So I think we need more research, and we need more discussion between people who are doing the research on brain injury or on lack of access with policymakers, with educators, with administration, and people in those key decision-making processes. Because, again, we cannot forget that there's not a lot of women sitting on international sports boards. There's not a lot of Blacks, Hispanics, and Asians sitting on other decision-making, large governing bodies.
And I know you have a book coming out next year about the sort of parallels between some of the racial hurdles and the sexual hurdles in athletics. And I know you don't want to give away too much, but can you tell us broadly about that book, what's coming up?
Sure. So I have a book that will be with Joe Mills Braddock, my mentor from the University of Miami, a professor there. And we are looking at segregation in sports context specifically, and how to diminish some of the barriers associated with historical and contemporary segregation.
When you say segregation, like, give me an example.
Sure. I mean, the common segregation would be blacks and whites, and also now we see in sports context, we see sex segregation specifically.
So, I mean, but are you saying, I mean, are separate teams for men and women in, say, basketball, is that a bad thing?
So that's what we're looking at, and that's what we're using research, and we're looking at some of the legal and social and moral arguments for and against segregation in terms of sex and athletics.
You don't want to give away your conclusion right now, I guess. Okay,
not yet.
Okay, fair enough.
It should be next summer.
Is there anything else about your work I may have missed, or anything else at all you think our listeners should know?
I think you covered a lot of it. I do think the one thing I do want to emphasize is the ideology of racial difference and disparity, and how that's really harmful, not just to racial minorities, but also to whites as well. So we want to talk about how any sort of inequality hurts the society in general. So if you tell white kids that black kids are naturally better at basketball, they might not try out for the team. Or if you tell the same thing with women, that they're not as good of athletes as men, you might be diminishing potential, and not just potential on the individual level, but for society in terms of health outcomes, in terms of reducing violence against women, in terms of improving safety. I mean, we looked at something, you know, like some of the disparities in the safety measures at college teams. Like, we saw that what happened at Grambling State, where if you're saying, you know, men should just tough it out, they should ride on a bus for, you know, whatever amount of hours they did, and have equipment that wasn't safe. I mean, this is harmful to our society.
So perception does really matter, doesn't it?
Yeah, ideology is going to affect outcomes.